It's the Gilmore Gabs. Gilmore Gabs. I was a little flat, but I love your harmony so much. Let's just do this for the hour. Let's just put it on loop. Welcome to Gilmore Gabs, where we talk to the cast and crew from a little TV show called Gilmore Girls. I'm Kevin.
I'm Dimmy.
And we are the Gilmore Gabs. Yes, we're the Gabs.
We're the Gabs.
Oh, man. Well, this interview series has gone phenomenally well so far.
It has.
We haven't screwed up yet. We've gotten great guests. We've gotten great little tidbits, and scoops, and nuggets.
Now I feel like you're cursing us by saying yet.
What? It's gone beautifully. So thank you to everyone who's listened, who came to the show after the Scott Patterson interview. That was so much fun. But we have a very, 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 very special treat today. Because not only do we have we had cast from the show on, or the composer of the show, but now, guys, we have one of the writers on the show today. And that's big news.
Ooh.
Goodness gracious. So let's introduce her right now.
La la.
Oh no. Where did
Kevin.
It go? This happened last time. Do you remember this?
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. Wait, okay. It's coming back. Here we go. This is going to work.
La la. La la.
A special guest. Well, you know her from her work on everything. We're talking Buffy, Angel, Firefly, Once Upon a Time, Battlestar Galactica, Caprica,
Husbands.
Dollhouse, Husbands. Yes, her web series. Ladies and gentlemen, it is Jane Espenson. Okay,
what an intro.
Was that good? Did we hype you up enough?
Yeah.
Yay. Half of the thing.
We did not. Like, oh my gosh.
I was looking at your IMDb before and I was like, oh my god, everything, really.
We didn't,
like,
a lot of things.
We didn't mention Game of Thrones. We didn't mention probably your most notable work, Dinosaurs.
Right, where I started, Dinosaurs, 1993.
Mm-hmm. What was the catchphrase from that show?
Not the mama? Yeah.
Was that you?
No.
Oh.
I was there at the very end for like
Feel
the last
free to take credit for it.
Four episodes. That was well established.
Gotcha. And then Game of Thrones, you did one episode on in the first season?
Season one. They didn't have a staff yet, so they were looking for a freelancer. So I did the episode where Daenerys eats the horse heart. And
oh,
then,
man.
Ooh, the gold.
The gold on
yes.
his head. Yeah, that was me.
Wow. How
it
fun.
Was really, really fun.
Is that fun to kind of like take on freelance gigs where you can like step into a world and then leave it? Or
that's my favorite thing. I love being a hummingbird and just swooping in, being on a show briefly, doing a few things. So the OC I was on extremely briefly.
Yeah.
And most shows I've only been on for one season because either a show only goes a season or I arrive there just as it hits its last season.
Gotcha.
I'm curious about Game of Thrones particularly because if you swoop in the first season, it's not like... Like, I'm sure there's a Bible and, like, there's the pilot to work off of, but how do you work off something like that with the book?
Game of Thrones, it's a totally different story from every other show because of the book.
Right.
So I was really just sort of assigned a chunk of the book.
Oh, okay.
Which made it very, very easy because it's already written.
Yeah.
So you got to do the fun parts, essentially.
Yeah. It's like a big scam. Like, oh, yeah, I'll write this episode. Thank you, George R.R., because it's already there.
Right.
It's a big scam, as says Jane Espenson. Quote her on Twitter.
Put that right on the DVD cover.
There you go.
Well, let's talk about just backing it up a little bit about your entry into television. How you got started as a writer, how you entered into the world of it. Now, you kind of bypass the typical route, right? Which would usually be writer's assistant, and then you work your way up in the room. How did that happen for you?
I'm not sure there is a typical route. There's so many different ways in. And yeah, you just described one of the most common ways, which is, you writer's assistant, although how to get those writer's assistant jobs is very mysterious. There's a whole ladder before the ladder that I don't even understand. Another way, a lot of people before or instead of that do sort of a film school path. I didn't do that. I went to grad school studying totally unrelated things.
Linguistics,
right? And computer science, yeah.
Did linguistics help at all with your writing later? Or?
I think it did because what I was studying was metaphor, which is part of semantics. So And TV is all about metaphor. It's all about how do you talk about a thing, but you're really talking about something deeper. So I certainly, either one helped the other, or they just both came from the same cause,
right?
Of whatever I'm interested in. But so I had no path in that way, and I just saw you could submit scripts to Star Trek The Next Generation without an agent. So that was a path a number of people used to get into the business at the time, was that all the Star Trek shows were always open for submissions.
Is that what Ronald Moore did as well?
Ron Moore was at Star Trek when I was there pitching. So he was like the baby writer that I, the embryonic writer, was pitching to. Mm-hmm. I don't know how he got in through there. Maybe his was a Writers Guild internship, or maybe he came in through pitching. I'm not sure how he got his job there. But it was certainly, it gave a number of writers. Lisa Klink went on to become a staff writer there and went on to other things. She started that way. I know other people did. And so you would just come down. I would come down from Berkeley, where I was studying, a couple times a year and pitch. And then through them, I learned about the Disney Writers Fellowship, which is another wonderful open door that still exists. That, and there are other writing fellowships that other studios have where people can submit their spec pilots or specs for existing show, whatever that program that you're applying to requires. An amazing open door. That's another alternate to the having to move here and become a writer's assistant. Although more and more of those programs are favoring people who are already here, already working at getting in, I think.
Right, because it's just easier with the proximity. And
yeah, I mean, it shows a devotion to choosing this as your career. I was not going to move to LA till I had something lined up.
Mm-hmm.
But I think I have a huge admiration for the people who are like, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to move to LA. I'm going to get an assistant job. I'm going to work my way up. I'm going to make it happen. That's a really good way in.
Yeah, and I wonder how much that's changed now just with, like, because of the even playing field of the internet now and the fact that people can do web series, you know, pretty much in their apartment for X amount of money. They can get a couple of 5Ds mm-hmm. and an editing suite. So I wonder if, like, the proximity to LA, obviously this is where so much of the work is, but I wonder.
I think we only have anecdotal evidence. Somebody needs to do a study or something, but it sure looks to me like people who want to get into the business but don't have the ability to move here, make something where you are. Absolutely. Make it big, make it great, get noticed.
Yes, which is so exciting because then it feels like a little limitless or a little more fair than it was even a few years ago when you first started.
And, you know, there's even, you know, some creative Twitter feeds get noticed and that can get you attention. That mm-hmm. can have people saying, oh, do they also have writing samples? You know.
Right.
So be creative where you are. Work to get here.
Yeah. Megan Amram.
Work at everything at once. Yes, Megan Amram is an excellent example. Yeah.
A former friend of the show. Former friend. I was going to say former guest and then friend of the show. And it became former friend.
She hates us.
We had a big falling out. Oh, man.
That's not true.
She said some unkind things. Just kidding. So you submitted to Star Trek and then through the Disney's fellowship, Disney Writer Fellowship, got a gig on
Dinosaurs. Yeah, that was my first one. Right. Dinosaurs was the first one. But I had already sold a pitch to Star Trek at that point. So in a way, that was the first thing. Depends how you define it. But then my first sitting in a writer's room was definitely Dinosaurs.
One thing I wanted to ask about, just because it was kind of a question mark when we were going over the resume, was a show called Me and the Boys.
Yeah.
What was I'm completely, and I'm such an ignorant millennial.
Was he, you'd heard of all the others? You had heard of Something So Right?
Yeah, Kevin's a big Something So Right.
Something So Right is right on my alley.
Me and the Boy and Monty. You had not heard of all the shows on my resume.
not Monty, unless it's Python after it, but probably
No, Monty was a lovely Henry Winkler vehicle. It was Henry Winkler, David Krumholtz, and David Schwimmer.
Fun.
As a family. It was really fun.
I'd watch that.
Yeah.
I'd watch that today.
Yeah.
Well.
Good grief.
But Me and the Boys was Steve Harvey. as a My Three Dads
type. I love it already.
Dad of three teenage boys.
This wasn't just a, this wasn't like a canceled show or anything. Or it was canceled, but.
It was indeed.
But like, did it run for a season or something?
Yeah,
we got a season. Familiar
yeah,
to me.
Yeah, it was really fun.
Me and the boys.
Yeah, he ran a video store because that was the times we were living in.
I love this Blockbuster. Man, we'll be in business forever.
Exactly.
And so we'll fast forward a little bit to Buffy.
Yeah.
To coming on to that show. Yeah. Now, you joined Buffy in the third season of that show.
That's right.
And how did that come about? After doing all these gigs, doing some shows that ran a little bit like Dinosaurs and some shows that didn't go as long, how did that meeting with Joss Whedon or the powers that be?
Yeah, I'd had five sitcoms at that point. Dinosaurs, Monty, Me and the Boys, Something So Right, and Ellen, each of which ran a season or less. Because I was, even for shows that ran for a while, like Ellen or Dinosaurs,
you'd be on the
I got there
one.
Right before they ended, yeah.
And that was coincidental. That was just like, that's so funny.
Well, I mean, perhaps I ran them into the ground. I don't think so.
What did you do?
I just happened to get there when they were ending. But other than Ellen, I felt like I wasn't really able to contribute as much as I wanted to. The room atmosphere rewards a quickness and an ability to sort of come up with your joke quickly and blurt it out convincingly in a loud room. And that just, I didn't feel like I was, Dinosaurs was not like that. Dinosaurs was a very thoughtful, quiet room where you could take your time. And Ellen was an amazing room that Tim Doyle ran beautifully, where you had the time to compose your jokes. The other rooms just were done in a very traditional sitcom way that I did not excel at. So I sensed that I would be better off in a drama room. Everyone was opposed to this because, like, you'll have to start all the way over. You know, you've done five shows now. You'll have to start at the beginning. I was like, because a drama writer and a comedy writer are considered two different jobs. I wrote an NYPD Blue spec script, so I had a drama sample, and I forced my agent at the time to send it out, and I said, make sure they get it at Buffy. That's where I really want to go. And he said, you got a meeting at Buffy. I couldn't believe it. And I went and I met with some reps of Joss's company, and they had me come back and meet with Joss, and I pitched him ideas, one of which ended up becoming the episode Band Candy.
Oh, of course, yes.
Which is my first one. And I got hired, and it was amazing. I spent 5 years at Buffy.
Wow.
Which is, to date, still the longest I've been on any show. I'll tie it this year
so
at Once
far,
Upon a
yes,
Time.
With Once Upon a Time.
That's right.
So on those other, the sitcom rooms you were talking about, I'm just curious, did it seem to be like more of like an atmosphere that favored the extroverted or the alpha? And if you weren't the quickest and loudest, then you wouldn't be heard. Was it more of a male dominated atmosphere, or was it just?
Yeah, it was definitely rewarded the assertive and the alpha and the quickness and the ability to think in a chaotic room. It did tend to be male-dominated. It was a lot of former stand-ups, so that's just people who'd been trained to think very quickly and to find the...
And be loud. Go quickly
to the comedy place and be loud. But there were definitely women who thrived in that. I don't think women should be scared of it. You know, if you're the kind of person who in a loud, laughing crowd of siblings at the dinner table or dorm mates in college or whatever, if you can come up with that topper for any, if anyone makes a joke, you know how to top it and get in there, mm-hmm. then you know you can thrive in that atmosphere. It's just, I don't seem, even for drama, I don't come up with dialogue that I like until I actually have my fingers touching the keys of the computer. I just somehow need to write my way into the lines. So my skills just weren't a good fit for that.
Gotcha. And yeah. So for these rooms, which were a little more aggressive, and then some good rooms like Ellen and Dinosaurs. When you got to the Buffy room, what was the, if there was an MO or a directive working under Joss and the producers there, what was the atmosphere of that room like?
That room was very quiet because, I mean, it was hilarious. Joss is hilarious, and the other people there, Doug Petrie in particular, and Drew Graham, people who crack me up. But it's a very top-down room, and it shared this with Gilmore. That sort of most of the ideas came from Joss, the best lines came from Joss, and there was a lot of sort of, we would do our best, like Joss was metaphorically swimming toward the solution, and we were trying to throw in bits of wood that he could cling to keep him afloat till he found the solution. It was very much like as much as we would try, we would never have the genius breakthrough idea. Would always, we'd always go like, Joss, if we think we've got it, this is brilliant. And he'd go, okay, oh, brilliant. What about this instead? And you'd go, okay, brilliant plus 20. Like, like no matter how brilliant we thought we were being, he was so much more. So it was a room, it was a great room because you were seeing someone work and come up with these amazing things, but it was also very hard to learn there because his process was so internal. You wouldn't see how he was coming up with his answer. He wouldn't show his work. He would just, he wouldn't let us put anything on the board till he had it really visualized in his head. So we'd go from nothing to suddenly him going to the board and writing the whole structure, the whole episode up there all at once. You're like, wow. Well, how'd you get there?
Yeah, and you don't, because it wasn't a transparent process.
No.
And yeah. It was just kind of some guesswork.
Yeah, yeah.
And but, so that's unusual, I guess, that because I guess when I imagine writers' rooms, I always think of like, they put cards up there, maybe mm-hmm. this happens in act three. I don't know, no, move that over to act two. But you're saying like, this was more of a process of love internal machinations and then spitting it out to
Was. And there would certainly be those times where, you know, he'd go, okay, I know these are the big moments, but let's think about whether this should go here or should go there. And then you'd have those conversations. But that's the moments I remember were him just going like, okay, I see it, and putting four acts up on the board.
Mm-hmm.
This is magic.
One thing that's kind of lovely about Buffy upon rewatch is that, well, there's definitely a unified tone. It's definitely Joss's show. There does seem to be like an episode-to-episode authorship as well. I think people, and especially fans of the show that watch it very closely, will know the difference between a Jane Espenson episode from a Marty Noxon episode mm-hmm. to a Doug Petrie mm-hmm. to a Drew Goddard episode. And so how do you retain that in a show and in a room where there needs to be a clear-cut, unified vision? How do you, and I'm sure your MO isn't like, this is my big chance to shine and show people I'm Jane, but like, but that it's clearly you and it's your work. Like, you would be so strong at like wordplay and jokes in mm-hmm. those little moments mm-hmm. that were so fun and light mm-hmm. and wonderful. Like, how do you retain that authorship?
I was trying not to. I really thought I was being a chameleon. I really was trying my hardest to sound just like Joss. I didn't want the episode to be recognizable as mine. So I was always really surprised when people would say they could tell my episodes. Looking back, yeah, we were allowed to have that, but it was not a stated goal. I felt like on Battlestar Galactica, I felt like that was the first show where I saw it, where I could starkly see the differences between the different writers and their episodes, because I think there it was even more prominent that each episode had the tone of the writers. Maybe just because there was a wider spread of writing styles there. So Michael Angeli's episodes and mine and Mark Verheiden's and Michael Taylor's, they all had a really, really distinctive, strong voices. It's no struggle to do that. It's wonderful. I love the texture it gave to Battlestar Galactica. That was the first time where I sort of learned to value it as like, oh, this is actually, isn't a knock against the show. It's a thing that gives a show texture. On Buffy, I would have felt like, oh, I'm not disappearing enough. I mean, your job isn't to show your voice. Your job is to sound like the show, generally.
And that came from Ron on Battlestar, that he would be like, do your thing.
Do your thing.
And then let me read it and we'll go from there.
Yeah, and Joss, the two things that both those shows have in common in the terms of the process was that the showrunner wouldn't take the episode and do a page one rewrite. Joss would give us notes and we would keep doing drafts till we had a version he liked. So it was the first time I remember turning in a third draft or a fourth draft. On sitcoms, you wouldn't get past two. So I was like, do we even type third draft or do we put second draft revised or something? Because I didn't even know you were allowed to put third draft on the script. On Battlestar, the same thing. And then again on Torchwood, where we would get to like 8th, 10th, 11th draft. Those were all shows where the showrunners wanted the final product to be yours would guide you through to the end.
Were those full revisions or was it like, oh, change this and that's a
By the
draft?
End, it was a very small change.
Right.
It would be, you know, by the 10th draft, you're putting in commas and
Take out that Oxford comma.
Yeah.
Don't need it.
And like, oh, we couldn't get the drugstore, so put this in a grocery store and you go change the slug lines or whatever. That was, it gets very easy. But it was always very much the sense of this is your episode from beginning to end.
Right.
So that it's very easy to maintain your own voice. Everyone has their own voice. The hard thing is subsuming it into the voice of the showrunner, which is a skill that I really admire because it is such a egoless skill to erase yourself from the script.
That takes a lot of humility because you are like putting yourself at the service of not only like the greater show, but then like just your boss at the time, whoever the head writer is or the showrunner is, and just kind of like absolving yourself of that.
Yeah, you have to pride yourself not on writing the best joke, but on writing the joke your boss would write. And that was
and those
something...
Sometimes they might be...
They might be different, but I've been really lucky that I've written for... I've fallen on a bunch of lucky shows. I've fallen on a bunch of good shows. I was the lucky one, not the show.
Oh, they might have been lucky for having you, though.
Luckily, I've never had to choose. I have failed to choose, perhaps, between the good joke and the joke my boss would write. Because I've always put down the joke I like. And that's why my voice doesn't disappear as much as it should.
No, but it's great. We love your voice so much. We don't want it to disappear. So... Buffy ends 2003 in the 2002-2003 season. And then from there, where do you go? Because Gilmore Girls, the season you were on, season 4, that was 2003-2004.
Right, so there actually was no time between them, except I managed to fit the OC in between. So I worked on the OC during my hiatus between the end of Buffy and the start of Gilmore Girls.
So a nice vacation working.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Well, it's a little extra money.
Yeah.
I got a call in my office at Buffy saying like I'm co-EP on this new show, The OC. We think you'd really dig it. Come in and write an episode. And I was like, well, I'll talk to my agent, I guess. And I was sure my agent was going to sort of go like, well, no, you've got Gilmore all set up. Take your vacation. Instead, my agent was like, oh, no, you should definitely do that. It's going to be a big show. It's going to run a long time. I think you'll have fun. It's good people. So I went and worked my hiatus at the OC, and it was a blast.
And so just using that as an example of like, we talked about Game of Thrones, but the OC as a first season show, you're coming in, they're still finding the tone.
Very much so. Yeah, you were asking about this, Demi, about what it's like to come in on a show season one when it doesn't. A show that doesn't yet know.
Well, there's no OC, the book.
And the fact the pilot had not yet been shot. The pilot had been purchased and written and purchased, but it had not yet been shot. So the showrunner actually wasn't in the room. He was off on set when they were shooting the pilot. We were in the room breaking, trying to come up with an arc for season one, trying to figure out what the early episodes would be. And the show very much changed during the month or 2 months or 3 months or whatever that I was in that writer's room. The episode that I wrote was episode 3. When we started breaking that episode, and when I wrote the first draft, it was about Ryan. Remember Ryan?
Oh, yeah.
He sent the families decided they can't take him in. He's got to go back to juvie. He's going to disrupt their lives too much. He goes back to juvie, and he gets knifed. He gets knifed in the cafeteria at juvie, and he's in the hospital, and the family comes to him and says, like, guess what? You're part of our family. Like, we can't live with knowing we're putting you in such a dangerous place. And he was a little bit... So, knifed in juvie. By the time it airs, Casino Night at the Country Club.
Really?
Yeah. Yes. Episode 3 is Casino Night at the Country Club.
I was about
club.
To say, I don't remember anyone getting knifed in the OC.
No. that's an example of the show finding its tone.
Oh, man.
Because there must be so much guesswork at that point when you have pictures of the actors, but you don't even see them inhabiting those roles.
Right. Exactly. Yeah, we had photographs of them and we were like, look, Ryan looks so much like a young Russell Crowe or whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah,
it was like, got
Ben McKenzie.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's like yes, thank you. Trying to figure out what the show is with so few pieces in place and actually getting reports back, you know, someone would go visit the set and come back and say, let's write this character a little less like this and a little more like that because the actor is not able to play that. They're able to play this really well. So let's move the character more toward this. So the whole tone of the show changed while we were sitting there working on it. So those of you who are out there developing your own show ideas that you are hoping that you're going to be able to sell to Hollywood once you get established as a writer here, you don't so much need, don't get yourself locked into a 5-year plan because of, you know, and then this will happen and then this will happen and this will happen, because you have no idea what a show goes through.
Right.
Before that, when that pilot's being written and when that pilot's being shot and when it goes through season one, season two, season three, all the unexpected things that that show is going to encounter that you can't control,
yeah,
that are going to change what that show is.
Like even actor schedules or actor chemistry that you, right, didn't anticipate. Like,
absolutely.
Oh, this works very well. Like in Gilmore Girls, yeah, Luke was originally a guest spot in the pilot. That's not a series regular, but then it became one.
In the and I think I remember Amy saying that in, right before they cast him, it was a character named Daisy. It was a female character.
Yes, that was, yeah, the name. I've been looking for it.
Yeah, and some executive or somebody, someone who the Palladinos really trusted said, you know what, if that was a male character, you might be able to use him as a love interest. It might, you know, you've got a lot of women, feel like you need, yeah, a guy.
There's hardly any men on the show thus far.
Yeah.
There's Michelle and Richard, which is a great problem to have.
Oh,
I'm not complaining.
Yeah, it's awesome. But and so I believe they changed the name from Daisy to Duke as kind of a joke. And then we're like, well, do we really like the name Duke? Let's name him Luke.
Daisy to, oh, Duke. Wow. This is why, because Scott Patterson is on our show, and he talked about how he hadn't prepared for the second scene, mm-hmm, in the script because the name it was under was Luke, whereas, yes, his name on the other page was Duke.
Oh, my,
right,
God.
Yeah,
that's
Luke.
That's funny.
That was Duke, and then he was reading Luke.
That's,
so that,
right,
was the misprint, but it was just like it must have been an old draft or,
yeah,
something.
Yeah, not, exactly, a misprint, really.
Wow.
That's so funny.
So you go straight in between Buffy, you go to OC, yeah, get in, you get out, Casino Night, yay.
Yeah.
And then, and then you can start Gilmore Girls.
Yeah.
This is season 4. So the show's been on for a little bit.
That's right.
And you're jumping kind of, I guess not to the same network because Buffy was on UPN at the time, but it started on WB.
Did Angel was on UPN? I think, well, yeah, maybe you're right.
I think Buffy switched to UPN for the last
did
2 years.
Did it switch?
It did.
I thought it was just in syndication.
No, I think it switched. Angel stayed on WB the whole time, and I,
oh,
think,
wow,
Buffy switched, oh, to UPN.
I will take your word for it.
Before they merged,
yeah,
to the CW.
I think,
yeah.
Yes, I think you're right.
But anyway, similar network,
mm-hmm,
especially writing for Angel as well.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're on a similar show. And this show, it's so interesting too, and I'm sure Amy talked about it even in hiring you and writing with you, that she would listen to old episodes of Buffy while writing,
right,
the show.
Right.
Would you witness that? Was that weird at all? Like,
I
did you
heard
encounter that?
That she listened to it, although I certainly get the similarities in rhythm. I know she used to have popcorn nights, Buffy and popcorn nights, with one of my bosses from the OC. One of the guys who hired me on the OC knew I was headed off to do Gilmore. That may be even be how he got in touch with me, because, mm-hmm, I had already been hired to do Gilmore.
Buffy and popcorn.
But
nights.
Yeah, I know that the two of them used to watch Buffy and eat popcorn, and so I knew she was a big fan. And that's often how you get your job, is someone's a fan of the show you're coming from, and so they when they hear you're available, they rush out and get you.
Yeah, that's gotta be a good feeling.
So
they're already rooting for,
yeah,
you. They love,
oh,
your,
yeah,
stuff, love your work.
But it also sets up certain expectations. Like,
yeah,
you know,
true.
You're coming in and they're going, and you know, you don't know if they know who they're hiring. They may think they're hiring the voice of Joss Whedon. It's like, I'm not Joss, and I cannot do what Joss does. Joss,
right,
is something special. So you go in and you're like, hope your expectations aren't too high. It's just little me.
And it's interesting too with Gilmore Girls, because you've certainly written for, at this point in your career, you had written for sitcoms, mm-hmm, and other shows that weren't super genre or,
right,
high concept.
Right.
But then, you know, your most notable work probably at that time was Buffy stuff, and was, mm-hmm, something super fantasy, mm-hmm, super genre. Is there any sort of like gear shift you have to go through into, okay, now we're getting away from like monsters as metaphor, and now we're doing grounded emotional reality where language is all the action? Or is it just like you do
You just do it. Yeah, you don't. I don't even think about that. That's,
wow,
just like if you sat down to write a short story, it doesn't matter where it's set so much. And I feel like sci-fi and fantasy is much more of a setting than it is like a way of writing. It's just where the story
It's an interesting point.
It's like, remember Captain Kirk said, and he said, you're from outer space. And he was like, no, I'm from Iowa. I work in outer space. it's you are yourself no matter what setting you're in.
Do you feel a shift in writing style when you have to go from comedy to drama or vice versa, or is it the same?
I feel like it's the same. You're thinking, what's the emotional truth of this moment? What would this character really say? And you write it down, and jokes and dramatic exclamations serve the exact same purpose. So they feel, when you're writing, they feel like they're coming out of the same bag.
Yeah, especially on Buffy and Gilmore, which was so not segregated to either of those genres. They were both hilarious and super dramatic. Mm-hmm. I think I read a great quote from you where you said, learn how to write jokes in comedy rooms, and then you do dramas and you can get them on.
That's right, because every joke in a comedy room has, by the time you watch an episode of a sitcom, every joke on there was not in the original draft.
It's like the 100th joke or whatever.
Yeah, exactly. They get traded out during the week-long process, and they get traded out again on set. And so very few of the original jokes get in. So you might work on a sitcom for a year and only have heard a few of your jokes actually make it to the air. But you learn how to write jokes. And then you go to a drama where the room is used in a totally different way. The writer's room, as I was talking about on a traditional comedy, you're actually rewriting the script in the room. So people are pitching lines of actual dialogue. You don't do that on dramas, except for very few. I know Desperate Housewives worked under a group rewrite method. But that's the only drama I can think of that I know does that. Mostly, if your line is rewritten, it's rewritten by the showrunner taking a pass through your script, but it is not subjected to a big group rewrite. Everybody pitch on every line of dialogue.
Right. You're all hanging out.
Yeah. You're working on story, not lines.
Mm-hmm.
So that means that if you put a joke in your script, it is very likely to stay and make it to the air. So, yeah. But in order for it to be good, it sure helps to have done a year or two on a sitcom.
Yeah.
If only because you learn that there's always another joke. I think a lot of times people who have not had experience in a comedy room panic when a joke is threatened because they're like, but that's the joke. It's like, no, even if the best joke in the script is ripped away from you, you will find another joke that serves the same purpose in your script. And jokes do, they serve a purpose. You can use a joke to lessen the tension. You can use a joke to highlight character, you can joke, to move story forward, to strike an emotional, whatever that joke did, there are 10 more that do the same thing that you can put in there. And you might even find that the best one is joke, the ninth one you think of.
Right. And so in your process, you would do that and serve the story.
Right.
You would switch out maybe different jokes or try harder and do this. So instead of getting locked into like, well, I really want to make a reference to Marquis de Sade.
Mm-hmm.
So how do I do that?
Don't
go about like that.
So right.
What does this character need right now? What does this need to communicate?
Exactly.
And so for the writing process on Gilmore, you'd come from Buffy and you're in the room. Season 4, you have 2 episodes to your credit.
Mm-hmm.
Episode, I think it's 404, Chicken or Beef, and then 416, The Reigning Lorelei.
That's right.
So for those 2 episodes, obviously you weren't just a freelancer, go in and go out. So for a season-long process, what does that look like for writers where you're not doing a group thing, where everyone's rewriting everyone else's scripts at the same time? Are you breaking stories together and that's like the majority of the work when you don't have an episode assigned to you?
Yeah. Or if you have an episode assigned to you, you're at home writing generally. Although I believe at Gilmore, that was one where we stayed in the offices and wrote in our rooms and tried as much as we could to still be in the room for the breaking of the next episode, if I'm remembering correctly. It seems like that's one of the rare times in my career where I have not gone home and written at home when I was out on an episode.
Which is probably preferable just because it's more comfortable.
It's more comfortable.
Yeah.
You can write according to your own rhythms. And it's also your chance to, you know, get to the doctors and get your car serviced.
Exactly.
And all those things that are helpful if you have a loose schedule. But there's also a good thing to be said for staying in the office, because then if there's a question in the writer's room, And people want to know, how did this, you know, how did you leave this in your script? Or can you come lend your brain because we're working on a problem. It's nice to be at hand. So there's advantages to both ways. And yes, the vast majority of, in fact, all the time in the Gilmore Girls offices were just breaking story in incredible detail. We had, it was a whiteboard show instead of, it wasn't cards pinned to a corkboard. It was a whiteboard with writing on it. And we would have, I think there were three boards, big things, classroom size boards, and they pivoted so there'd be front and back side and you could write on either side. We would fill them full of very tiny writing. The letters were like half an inch tall. You had to sort of get up and get close to the board to read them. And it was not written in the normal outline shorthand that goes on a writer's room board. Writer's room board, you always fill a number of boards, but usually with much larger writing, like 3-inch tall letters in all caps. And usually it's a little diagrammatic. It's a little, you know, Bronze, Buffy / Willow, talk, re, big bad.
Buffy, yeah, a lot of shorthand.
Yeah, very shorthand, very headline style.
Mm-hmm.
Our show, it would be Luke Steiner, Rory, and Lorelai enter. They sit.
Wow.
Rory, colon, like, what have you been doing? Like, so it would actually have a lot of pieces of dialogue in it. It would always be complete sentences. It was never open door. It was always open the door.
Mm-hmm.
And that would go up there. And so we would spend our time talking about our lives, funny things that had happened to us in our lives. A lot of times, a lot of those stories came from the lives of the writers, or just funny notions that somebody had, or just our take on what Rory or Lorelai would do next in their lives as they were at that point in the season. And we would come up with the sort of rough shape for a story, refine it. We're working with Amy, we're working with Dan, but sometimes they're not in the room. So maybe we're on our own. And this was me and Sheila Lawrence and Janet Leahy and John Stevens were the staff that year.
And that was it?
That was it.
That's a pretty small room,
tiny little room. Yeah, exactly. And we would come up with these stories and we'd write them up on the board and we'd pitch them to Amy. Sheila would do the pitching generally. And Amy and Dan would go yes or no, or I like this or I don't like that. And it was but generally they sat and they listened, and it was a great audience. And Amy would know exactly when she heard it, you know, yes, that sounds like us, no, that doesn't. It was a show that did not have a lot of theme coordinating the A and B story. So generally, Lorelai would have something happening in her life and Rory would have something happening in her life, but one didn't stand metaphorically for the other. And that was a big adjustment for me, because I would go, oh, look, someone's telling a lie in that story. Look, if Rory lies in her story, then maybe we can get sort of a theme going where there's sort of a resonance between the two. And I remember, like, one of my first days there, I said that, and Dan was like, yeah, we don't really do theme.
That's so interesting, because that's definitely something that's hit hard on Buffy and shows like that.
Absolutely. And at the time, I didn't understand why they did it. And now I so get it, and I so respect that choice. That show valued one thing above all other things, and that thing was realism. So more than any other show I've worked on, the rule was always, sort of, does it feel like life? What would happen next? So stories would have, you'd have like a 7-page scene of two people on the phone talking about the dramatic moment that actually happened off screen. Like that breaks every rule of drama. You'd have stories that end early. You'd have stories that would start late, like a new character might walk in the third act or something. And I was always going like, this is the weirdest storytelling ever. And now I see, and what I gradually realized was, this is serving the purpose of verisimilitude. You are surprised when things happen because the story didn't set it up. You're surprised when the exciting moment happened between the seasons or off screen or is being talked about on the phone.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's how life works. Stories don't start and end with everything wrapped up. People do come out of left field. Weird things happen. And you don't always see the dramatic moment. And scenes with conflict are very, very dramatic. They can also be a little upsetting. The show was not up. The show was very comforting. You were with people that you liked talking about stuff. And it, like I say, it breaks every rule, but there was something about it that made for a show that was a pleasure to watch and that felt like life. I've had a lot of people come up to me and say, my daughter and I are just like Rory and Lorelai. People say Buffy got me through high school, but they don't say I'm just like Buffy. People identify with the Gilmore Girls in a way more than any other show I've worked on. They aspire to be Buffy, or they aspire to be, I don't know, President Rosalind or something from Battlestar Galactica, but they rarely say, like, that life feels just like mine. I'm glad your life doesn't feel like President Rosalind's.
Oh, gosh, that'd be not good.
but people are willing to make that jump with Gilmore Girls. They do. They feel like they are, that their lives feel like that life they're seeing on the screen. And I learned so much from being there about getting off the story high horse of conflict. Always has to be conflict. Every scene has to be a revelation.
Even act breaks.
Yes, the act breaks were not constructed. Every other show, you sort of build those act breaks, and they are big moments that turn the story. On Gilmore Girls, they often were just sort of where you were on the
right
page.
See you later.
Yeah,
exactly.
It was, and the episodes often didn't even end at a climactic moment. When the first episode, where I was in the room as we were roughing out the story, I remember distinctly Dan Palladino going like, okay, I think that's enough story for this episode. And I was thinking, what, like, it's toothpaste that comes out of a tube and there's enough to fill the space and you stop, instead of like, this is the natural ending for the story.
Yeah.
And it's like, because he was seeing it as life. There's enough things happen and time passes and the day ends. And that doesn't mean, just because it's 10 p.m. and you're getting ready for bed, that doesn't mean that that your day has concluded in a satisfying tie up the loose ends kind of way.
Right.
It doesn't happen that way. And the show, I really, really have grown to value the lessons of this show, of a show that moves and feels like life is unprecedented. And it shows that we hold ourselves up to standards that not only are they not always necessary, but they sometimes can work against it. A show, you write a show that is perfectly structured, it's going to feel very satisfying, but it's not going to feel like life.
Yeah, so it's accomplishing a totally different thing.
Exactly.
In that way. We've been talking about this for, you know, 3.5 seasons at this point, trying to crack the code of the show, essentially, because it was such a, the thing we've compared it to a lot on the podcast is that it's so much like a novel.
Yes.
Even though it's not like hyper serialized, like then chapter 4 goes into chapter 5 and Jack Bauer is hanging off a cliff,
right.
But that it's, the way it weaves and moves in, the word I've used before is flatness, but that sounds reductive or negative. But like you're saying, if everything is an equal thing and then boom, this happens, then you feel that so much more than if every act break was a da da da.
Right.
And yeah, and maybe evenness is a better word than flatness or something.
Because
I had this,
yes.
My toothpaste image is the same image of there's this even substance of the show, and yes, if there's peaks, they're going to stand out. And you're right, I think most shows are a little mountain range. It starts at the sea level and then it goes up and it's jagged, 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 and it comes down to the sea level at the end. And this is much more of a mesa.
We're painting a picture here, guys,
yeah.
With toothpaste. Got a lot of imagery happening here.
I know, but there is something, we're getting to something. There is something real about what we're talking about with the show and how it differs.
Yeah, so beautifully stated. We've been trying to figure it out for so long, and then you just like nailed it.
Well, I was there.
You were there. You would be an authority on it more than we would. This is true. And so, comparing it even to like an experience like Buffy, where you are trying to, fit into the Joss Whedon voice and trying to essentially mimic his voice. I'm sure it works similarly on this show, where Amy Sherman-Palladino has such a distinct voice.
Absolutely.
Fast talking, pop culture reference, hyper literateness.
Yep.
grounded emotional realities.
Mm-hmm.
How do you feel like your sense of authorship was on Gilmore as compared to Buffy?
On Gilmore Girls, your sense of authorship came in the breaking of the story.
You were talking about like how different stories from your own life would inform the lives of the characters. Do you remember any tidbits like that that came to be, that became a Lorelai beat or something?
Yeah, I remember pitching the idea that there was a tree on campus that Rory liked to sit under, and then someone took her spot
under the
tree. And the sort of weird sense of like, favorite spot under a tree is not an assigned seat, and yet somehow I feel proprietary of it.
Yeah,
and that was something I pitched, and it wasn't based on a specific thing, but it was certainly based on the sort of observations and you know, general campus experiences that I'd had. I remember bringing that in. But other writers brought in very personal things. I think the night terrors thing was based on one of the writers and from their actual life.
And we haven't gotten to that yet, but we will. Demi's watching it for the first time. I've been a fan of it for a long time.
Oh, exciting.
So, yeah.
That definitely came from a writer's personal life. And because the stories were broken in such detail, you would feel a lot of ownership of you know, this beat and that beat in this moment and bringing that character in here. And that funny thing Michelle said, that was on the board. That was something I came up with, whatever. But you could not take a lot of... It would be better not to anticipate that you were going to have a lot of ownership of your script, because Amy was a certain kind of showrunner where, because their voice is so specific and because the texture of the show, as we were talking about, is so uniform, what distinguishes it, what makes it an episode of Gilmore Girls, is not anything to do with the shape. It is that voice.
Mm-hmm.
It is the thing that is, that defines whether or not it's a Gilmore Girls show. And the best chameleons, and we were all trained chameleons, none of us could write an episode that would not end up having a great deal of rewriting. And as the new kid, I think I probably had more than most. So there were very, very few lines in the episodes with my name on it that I actually wrote. I wrote the rough draft. I took it from the board, put it down on paper, wrote the rough draft, and gave her the template on which she could paint. So you served your purpose by getting the scenes down in a form that she could then go in and do her thing with them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not a negative thing at all. That's how that show had to work. I recently reread the cold open of one of them. I can't remember which one it was, but I think it was The Raining Lorelei, and it was a family dinner. And I was reading it, and I was reading my version of it, and I was laughing at some of the jokes I'd written, but I was also thinking, like, this isn't it. This isn't Gilmore Girls. This does not have that. I mean, her voice is as distinctive as her speaking voice. I could no more imitate her on the paper than I could sit here and make you think that that was her spoken voice coming out of my mouth. It's that unique.
Wow. Something like, one thing we always wonder about too, is when it comes to, because we're talking about how like writers would inform story beats and they would inform the template and essentially beat that out so she could write on it. One thing, and it may be such a non sequitur and such a dumb question, but the thing about the pop culture references, we always talk about that on the show. We do super cuts for every episode and we go over every single pop culture reference on the show. And so was that ever something that the staff in general would contribute to? Was there ever a directive to like, okay, we need this many pop culture references? Or was it just like totally organic?
No, it was just part of the fabric of the show. So if you thought of one when the story was breaking, it might make its way into the up on the board, and it might make it into, it might be just something you thought of when you were writing the episode that would make it in, and it might stick or it might get replaced by Amy in the rewrite. But that's just when you write on a show, you know how that show sounds. And so that's just part of your job as a chameleon, is to go, okay, the show, these characters live in a pop culture world and they relate into things in a pop cultural way. This would be how they'd think about this moment. This would be what it would remind them of, or this is the reference they'd make. And so you'd put it in and she'd keep it or trade it. But those were very much just things she was interested in. If she was watching a particular, you know, cooking show on the Food Channel or something, then that would be what reference would go in. It's sort of Amy was the template for Lorelai. So I think the only person who knew it was in Lorelai's head was Amy. So the things Amy was interested in were the things Lorelai was interested in.
Which was why, truth be told, I've prided myself on like, oh, I've seen this show so much. I'm a big fan of it. And then I'm like showing it to Demi. That's kind of the premise of the show. And we go through it with different like writers and comedians and such. But I have not seen the seventh season.
Oh.
Because.
It's not Amy.
Because it's not Amy. So is it the show?
It is, however, a Buffy writer. Rebecca Rand Kirshner Sinclair.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, ran that season. And she's amazing. And I'm sure she did a great job. I didn't watch it either, but that's mostly because I find it very hard to watch a show after I've been involved in it. Then it feels like,
yeah. What's that experience
it's
like?
Someone else is wearing your underpants. It's just
it's like, a violation.
Well, it depends how you feel about your underpants. I guess it's not really. It just isn't. It's just you feel bad that they were able to survive without you. Maybe no. I don't. But it's or maybe it's just you can't suspend your disbelief anymore. It doesn't feel like a show anymore.
Yeah, you saw how the sausage got made.
Well, yeah, and it feels like home movies that were taken after the family went on without you, left you at the campsite. I don't.
Yeah, that totally makes sense. I totally understand why that would be the case.
Yeah,
and so your time on Gilmore, like when you think about that, like a video snapshot of like what would be kind of the best part or the best image of like, wow, that was a fun job, or that was rewarding or creatively satisfying or like interesting because I learned a lot or I met wonderful people. Like, what do you think of when you think about that year that you
first
were on the
I
show?
Want to correct that analogy. It's more like home videos after you went off to college.
Oh, okay.
Because I left the show very happy. Everyone was happy.
Sure.
They did not abandon me at a campsite.
Yeah, they didn't leave you on the side of the road.
No, I went on to other things.
Yes.
What do I think of when I look back on it? I look back at the amazing people I met there. That team was amazing. But really, it's that lesson about how many rules you can break and the importance of making a show that feels like life and embracing reality as a value. I think that really is something I've taken with. What I took from Buffy was the what's the Buffy of it? That every show had to be about something, had to be about something emotional, deeply emotional for the character, or there's no point in telling the story. You know, why are we telling this story? I got an entirely different lesson from Gilmore Girls. It would seem to be the opposite lesson, which is sometimes a story doesn't need a reason to exist. It exists because life happens.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think they are opposite lessons. I think these two things can be put together and have a show that says something, but also feels identifiable and feels like life and has some of the unexpected syncopated rhythms of life instead of always falling on the beat. And I think the two work together really well. And you might look at a show like Battlestar and say, there's a show that I think captures both things, even though it's certainly a heightened world. You still get the sense of those characters going to their quarters at the end of the day and that they feel like real people.
Mm-hmm. And it's funny, too, with Gilmore because we talk about realness and the evenness just as life occurs. But it's a show, too, that's presented in kind of a fantastical way
mm-hmm.
in the hyper-literateness of the characters,
yes.
The fast-talking, almost Sorkin-esque, hyper-witty, super funny. Everybody
that's
has
true.
The same well of pop culture references. So it's such a fun, interesting, it's almost like peanut butter and chocolate coming together because it's such like, there's this thing that is aspirational in the mm-hmm. way that Buffy is. Like, oh, we wish we had that courage or bravery or could like,
or that relationship, that mother-daughter relationship.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's aspirational. And then we all wish we could be funny like that,
mm-hmm,
too. Or
mm-hmm.
we wish we could, like,
right.
live in that town and know those townies and Babette and Miss Patty and Kirk and all
yes.
those people.
Oh, my God. That town. That crazy town.
Yeah.
I think about that town sometimes when we're writing Once Upon a Time, which also has the central cast of characters and the small town feel to it. And I do think about the way that we got invested in so many different characters on Gilmore Girls in a way that's incredibly hard to do to keep all those characters alive and involved in story after story. Amazing.
You did Gilmore for a year, worked on shows like Battlestar and Torchwood.
Right.
And then coming to Once Upon a Time, which will, you said, as of this year, will tie your
That's
duration
right.
on Buffy and may even break it for next year.
Well, yeah, actually, because the... No, you're right. It will just tie it. I was going to say the first season of Buffy was a half season, but that's before I was there. So yeah, it will. It'll tie it.
Wow. So what are some of the lessons, kind of like you learned deep emotional beats on Buffy, or not learned, but it was reinforced and you learned the value of evenness and verisimilitude. Mm-hmm. And what do you feel like are some like lovely takeaways from your job now? A show where it is kind of maybe more in the vein of Buffy, where... characters are acting as metaphors and there needs to be a deep emotional conflict in every episode, and there's probably not the evenness of real life.
Right, yeah, it's definitely heightened and, yeah, much and very beautifully structured. David Goodman, who was the assistant, the writer's assistant at Buffy, is the co-EP who runs the writer's room at Once Upon a Time.
Wow.
So there is Buffy lineage
DNA,
coming.
Yeah,
yeah, exactly. And I think the thing that Once Upon a Time does so beautifully is to make a compelling structure in the current six acts that we use to tell a story these days in network TV. Buffy days, it was four. Then it became five. Then it was five plus a teaser. Then it was six. Now it's six plus a teaser. So the story gets very... there's a tendency, if we do our structural thing again and we picture this time... a rope... And if you only have to twist that rope four times, the rope stays fat. If you have to twist that rope six times, what happens? The rope has to get skinnier. You have fewer pages before each act ends. So there's less time for the story to get deep, to have long scenes and deep exploration of the story before it has to turn. So I think there's a tendency for network shows now to get a little shallow, because you can't go very long before you're turning it. And what Once Upon a Time does is it packs so much story and so much emotion into those six acts that you don't ever feel that it's going to be shallow. It stays deep. It just does it efficiently. And so I think the story breaking at Once Upon a Time is, it's like a little Swiss clocks. They are put together so precisely. That no time is wasted, so you can get a sense of depth in a very short number of pages before each act turns. And I'm really trying to learn as I sit in the room and I watch these episodes to come together. I'm trying to learn how it works. You never stop learning. Every show has something to teach you.
That's amazing. And so I imagine it must be such an interesting challenge now, just because when you first started, going from a 4X structure to a 6X structure, it seems like it'd be analogous, but it's really a whole new ballgame.
It really changes things. It really does. Because you, in particular, I found 5 very odd because it meant there was no midpoint. You know, the middle point of your story was in the middle of an act. So where does the big mid episode turn go, before act 3 or after act 3? I found that very weird. At least now we're back to an even number.
So there's a little bit of comfort there.
Yes, exactly.
That's so fun.
I know. What are we going to do when we go to 7? I don't know. I'll just
is 7 step, coming?
Oh, I'll no. step back and wait for 8 because I like the even numbers. It's like Star Trek movies. Even ones are the best ones.
Is that true?
That's famous.
What the saying is.
Yeah. I've never heard that. That's so funny.
Yeah, just take a look at them. The even ones are the good
ones. I'm not a big enough Trekkie.
clearly.
One. Okay, well.
Yes, now you need the companion podcast where you show him
Star Trek.
Only the movies, though.
Okay.
Just the movies?
Just the movies.
TV show? What if there was every single episode of every single TV show?
It would
take
a while.
In like the 600, 700 episodes.
It's worth doing. I went back and watched some original Trek recently.
Yeah?
And boy, it's worth a lot. It's you know, as it gets farther and farther in the past, it sort of fades in our memory into sort of a technicolor blur. But oh my God, they were solid. Those episodes are worth looking at.
There's some really good episodes.
The original with Kirk and Nimoy and whatnot.
Yes.
That's so fun.
Wait, Kirk and Nimoy.
Kirk and Nimoy. Yeah. Wait. Captain,
Shatner.
No, Shatner.
I was like,
I was trying to figure out which one I was switching. Kirk and Nimoy. Yeah, that's so fun. I'm trying to think of any. Oh, one thing we'd be remiss to not ask you, and you may not have an opinion on the third one, just given your experience on the show, but we need to ask if you're, as far as Rory's boyfriends are concerned, if you're Team Dean, Team Jess, or Team Logan.
Or team none of the above.
Or team Rory single forever.
You know what? Well, not forever, but Rory was very young. And I think that everyone deserves a chance to become the person they're going to be. You have to be cooked cookies, you know? and Rory's still becoming who she's going to be. And I think that probably being single is probably the right thing for, even at the end of the series, that character was very young. You should wait till you're 30.
Date no one. Wait till you're 30. And
she
then see what's
date.
Going on.
She can date. She can date. Oh, in fact, I'm team all of the above, not none of the above.
Ooh.
You should date a lot of different people and get to know a lot of different kinds of guys.
Right.
And then she can pick.
That's the first time we've gotten that answer. That's so fun. Because it is, there's so many, a lot of people are team Jess, as played by Milo Ventimiglia. I feel like a lot of the fan base gravitates towards him. In examining the show, in retrospect, we don't like him as much because of the way he treats her and mistreats her. But it is one thing that does come up is the necessity of those experiences to kind of shape the person that you are.
Right.
Absolutely. Yeah, they're all the guys you love are all part of what makes you who you are.
True.
Yeah.
That's what I've always said.
Yeah.
Is there, in the writer's room for Gilmore, do you feel like there was a character you gravitated towards, like you really enjoyed writing, whether it be Paris or Emily or even Doyle from
I love Doyle.
Mr. Danny Strong.
Strong, the head of the Empire called Empire, was Doyle on the show. And that may be my lasting contribution to the show because that I suggested him. And Amy and Dan had worked with him before but hadn't thought of him. And so as soon as I said the name, they were like, yes, of course, Danny. We've been wanting to do something for Danny. So he was sort of already in the air, but I pitched him. He's brilliant, brilliant. But Paris was the one I liked writing for. Just that I love a blunt character. Reminded me very much of writing for Anya.
Yes.
Very much, very similar voice. And I think those two performers are sort of perform the bluntness in a similar way.
Mm-hmm.
There's something enduring about the way they just say what they're thinking, and that they both did. And Paris.
No question.
No question.
The one you're in love with.
The one I'm in. The one I love. She's my favorite character.
Yes.
Oh, man. And then just because Gilmore Girls is such a show centered on pop culture and consuming content. They're always watching a different movie. Mm-hmm. I was thinking about what the pop culture references would be now if it was on. There'd probably be a lot of Taylor Swift talk, I would assume.
They'd have opinions about Taylor Swift.
The Avengers.
A lot of opinions about that.
I bet they'd be negative on Taylor Swift. They would talk about the comic book movies, but
I think Emily would have an opinion about there being too many of them.
Yes, exactly.
There's too many. I lost track after Age of Ultron.
Yes, really. It would be about like must everything have originally been a comic book?
Mm-hmm.
Like that's
the franchisedness of.
Well,
of
and the comic
movies.
Books were. There was a reason we threw out your comic book collections, kids. Like they were They're silly. They're little drawings. Some of us read books with words. It would be that. That would be sort of her attitude of like, are you know, these things were useless to begin with, and now they are. And now they are all that is out there. I think Emily would have a negative take on that.
I feel like the voice that Dan Harmon uses for Community, where it's like, oh, everything's meta now, almost like a commentary on his own
on
stuff.
His own
right.
show.
Is sort of what Paladino would do now.
Yeah, very well could be. Yeah, it'd be everything. She'd have thoughts on Cronuts and
definitely Cronuts.
Yeah,
that was a show where man, they just ate all the time.
Well, they'd love Cronuts.
Yeah, they'd be down.
Oh yeah,
in them.
They'd love the Cronuts. Yeah, whatever the current food oh, there'd be thoughts about small plates and you know, there'd be a joke about like, I like the food that you get in a small plate place, but I really would like it on a big plate.
Yeah.
Like if it's good enough to eat, it's good enough to eat more of it.
So true.
Yeah.
What kind of stuff are you enjoying right now in terms of music and movies and TV shows? And how do you feel like that informs what you're working on now too?
Well, I very much am enjoying the recent comic book movies. Mm-hmm. Joss Whedon's Age of Ultron was awesome. I've been listening to a lot of audiobooks during my commute. I've been The Gone Girl and the books of that ilk. I've been really enjoying that sort of unfolding mysteries told, yeah. But there was one recently called The Girl on the Train that I really loved. And a lot of nonfiction. I've been reading a lot of books about, the collapse of Enron and other similar schemes that mm-hmm. fell apart. I always find those very fascinating.
That's great. Well, yeah. I feel like, just in general, your career, you've been so wonderful through your website and through Twitter, doing writing sprints and being so transparent about your process and just being so generous, too, with the kind of wisdom that you've gleaned and lessons that you've gleaned, even in this podcast. You're responsible for, like, so many, probably at this point, hundreds of hours of TV shows that yeah. we've watched, you know, absolutely through Once Upon a Time and Battlestar and Caprica mm-hmm. and all these shows. So, and then obviously your contributions on Gilmore Girls are so felt, and thank you so much for being so transparent with us about that process. And it's so fun to hear, and especially for beautifully saying what we've been struggling like dummies to say for so long in terms of like, what is this show? It's so different and so interesting for a reason, but we can't quite put the finger on it.
It really is unique and special. And you mentioned the website. The website, it's janicebenson.com, but I haven't updated it in like 5 years. But it's writing advice, and it's all still there and archived. And if people are interested in learning more about how to find that exact mm-hmm. right word for the joke you're writing,
yeah,
absolutely.
You might find something.
It's super helpful. Your Twitter's been super helpful. Well, actually, let's just we'll transition to a segment we call "Where You Tweet, I Will Follow," which is obviously
nice.
We even have a cross stitch for it up there. But
oh yeah,
it's up on the show.
That's fantastic.
So people can find you on Twitter.
Yeah, I'm just plain old at Jane Espenson.
At Jane Espenson, Espenson.
Very good.
Yes. MOUSE.
Yeah.
And you often do writing sprints on your Twitter. Yeah. So talk about those, because those are so fun and people love participating in them.
I love Twitter, and I was noticing that I was losing time, writing time to Twitter. And I was like, okay, the only way I'm going to be able to get something done is if I make Twitter hold me accountable. So I sort of announced I'm going to be writing for the next hour. If you've got a project you've been putting off, maybe you want to write too, or go do your garden or whatever. So I announced it, and people love it. I've got people who are dedicating their dissertation to me or their novel or whatever because they
wow
like I would never have done this much writing without you holding me accountable. So if you anytime you're on Twitter, check at Jane Espenson. See, maybe I'm calling for a writing sprint and you can get some work done for an hour.
Check Jane Espenson. Watch Once Upon a Time. Watch mm-hmm. Husbands. Mm-hmm. Oh, also, I just want to ask this from a writer's perspective. Amy Sherman-Palladino said she had the finale of the series down to the final two words.
Yeah, I remember her saying that.
Yeah. She didn't share them with you.
Nope.
Did she share them with anybody?
I don't think so.
Wow. If you had to guess, as someone whose job it was to emulate her voice, it can be a silly guess. It can be a joke. We've guessed Gilmore Girls are the last two words.
Makes sense.
I've guessed, oh no. Really, I think shut up might be the last two words. Really, it might yeah, be. It's like a gentle thing Lorelai says to Rory.
My new idea is damn it, Taylor.
Damn it, Taylor.
From Luke.
Okay. That checks out. What would be your vote if you had to vote?
Maybe sort of an and then.
Ooh.
Imagine sort of the notion sort of fading out on the two of them talking and Lorelai's telling a story and she says, and then.
Wow.
Black.
That would fit into the realism of just ending on.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And they're like in a diner and like maybe a Journey song is playing.
Don't stop.
And it just cuts to black immediately.
Yeah.
Well, Jane, thank you so much for joining us on this episode. It's been so, so fun.
Thank you.
We've learned so much about writers' rooms and about jokes and about verisimilitude, which is a word I need to use more often so I pronounce it more correct.
Thank you for having me. What good, insightful questions. This has been a blast.
Thank you. And we'll find you on Twitter at Jane Espenson, Husbands.
That's right.
Once upon a time. Thank you.